Testament books and spiritualize them so that they end up sounding like the New Testament. And that is to do a great disservice to God's self-revelation in the Old Testament. It's not to see it for what it meant to the people of that day, and we may very often get the wrong lessons out of it. God's ultimate purpose is to sum everything up in Jesus Christ. The letter to the Ephesians is very clear about that. But because God, of course, knowing ahead of time we were going to fall, then must do something to make sure that everything is summed up one day under His Son, Jesus Christ. That means His Son must come into this world, provide for the fallenness of this human race and the fallenness of the world, offer the sacrifice to God that would be sufficient to deal with the whole question of sin, which means backing up another step. There must be a people into which He can be born, which means there must be a nation, and there must be a land. He cannot be a nomad. And so God must work, backing up another step, to make sure there is a people in a land where His Son can be born, where He can die. And this is what God is working at through Old Testament history, is developing that people and getting them ready for the birth of His Son and ultimately for His sacrifice. So in the Old Testament, God is not only preparing a people physically, He is preparing a people spiritually. And God has designed their religious observances so that when His Son comes and offers Himself, there will be no surprises. They should have, from their own history, expected that this is what would happen. When God, for instance, well, to back up another step, to develop this people out of His chosen Abraham, there is no way that nation is going to develop in Palestine. For two reasons. The topography, it's too broken up. And a unified nation, or at least a family, cannot grow into a large nation in such a divided country. And the second reason is it's the major battleground of the Near East. The two major powers would grow up in Mesopotamia and Egypt. And they were always meeting in Palestine. And it was not only the major highway, it was the major battleground. And it's very hard to develop a family into a nation in no man's land. It's hard to do that. So God moves them into Egypt, where they have security and the time and the place and the space to develop into a great nation. And because they are enslaved by the Egyptians, then God must work them out of Egypt to bring them into the land where He wants His Son to be born. To get them out of that land, God had a million ways He could do it. He could levitate them right out, whatever. I'm thinking of Sunday school stories, and I better not get into those. God chose to do it through that blood of a lamb. He didn't have to do it that way. But He's beginning to impress on His people that deliverance for human beings, His people, deliverance comes through death, through the sacrifice of another. And the whole ritual of the tabernacle impresses certain basic lessons on the people of Israel. You'll see those in the letter to the Hebrews. The letter to the Hebrews, by the way, shows you how to handle typology. And I wish many of us who handle typology would stick with what the letter to the Hebrews does. But there are certain basic lessons, like the holiness of God, which means we can't approach Him as we are. The need for a mediating priest. The need for a sacrifice for sin. Those are the basic lessons God is impressing on His Old Testament people. So that when His Son comes and offers Himself as a sacrifice for sin, that should come as no surprise. Unfortunately, it did, but it shouldn't have. Because in picture form, that's what God was teaching His people. But to get His people out of Egypt and into Palestine, this is how God does it. Now, the book of Joshua is part of that process of God getting His people into the land where He wants them, where His Son can be born. It's the furtherance of that long history that will climax first in the coming of Jesus Christ into the world, and then secondly in his second advent. And Joshua picks up the story when Israel has come out of Egypt and through the wilderness, and now Joshua is the story of their coming into the promised land. It does a couple of other things. It stresses, again, the faithfulness of God to his own covenant with his people. That's the story of Joshua. It's the revelation of God's faithfulness. God made a commitment to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob. And God will keep that commitment. And the book of Joshua is part of the unfolding of the faithfulness of God to his covenant with his people. It also tells us, as it told Israel, that if we are going to be part of the purposes of God, we must be faithful to the covenant with God. Now it's the covenant at Sinai that comes down upon the people of Israel. That's a bad way to put it. It sounds like it was a terrible thing. It was a great thing. I'd love to talk about the place of the law and the relationship of the believer to the law. Some of us sometimes, I think, misconstrue. I'm doing it anyhow, aren't I? Well, that's the way I taught school, and all the students had to do was get me off on one of my favorite tangents, and we'd never get to the subject for which they were totally unprepared anyhow. But we have to deal with Old Testament people saying, "Oh, how I love thy law. It's my delight. I delight in the law of God." We have to deal with that. We can't just look at the law as something negative. It was a great joy to the Israelite who realized that his relationship to God was based on the mercy of God and not on his obedience to the law. The law then became a great joy as the way through which he expressed his love for God. And the book of Joshua shows that obedience to that law, not obedience divorced from relationship, that's legalism, but obedience that comes out of personal relationship, that is the key to being part of the fulfillment of the purposes of God. And Joshua will teach Israel, the book of Joshua will teach Israel, it's as you lovingly, in response to God's initiative, as you lovingly commit yourself to God through obedience to his command, that you begin to see in your own history the fulfillment of the purposes of God. Now I'm going to say one other word about that. The obedience that they had to give, and even that sounds so negative, that they had to give. Yes, they had to give it. But God wanted it out of the spontaneous love and joy of their hearts. Not cold, mechanical, we have to do it sort of thing. But that obedience centered in the moral law, not the ritual law. Now, it's not that they could discard the ritual law, but the emphasis is always on the moral law, not the ritual law. When God gave them the instructions to build the tabernacle, if you're like me sometimes, dare I confess this, and it's on tape, that I get bored reading all those details. And that just happens to be where my daily reading is right now. And hear all the details of how they are to construct the tabernacle. Then the whole thing is repeated when they build it, down to the last detail. I say, okay, what that shows is they carried out exactly the instructions that God gave. But that is never said of their obedience to the moral law. It's much more difficult to build a life according to the moral law than it is to build a tabernacle according to the ritual law. Now, what happens to us human beings is because it's easier to follow the ritual, that's where we put the emphasis. We like to emphasize what we can do, not what we don't do. So we put the emphasis on the ritual rather than on the moral. And we may in the assemblies be satisfied that we carry out the ritual of the Lord's Supper every Lord's Day, because that's easy to do. It's much more difficult to love each other as Christ loves us. It's much more difficult to live a holy life as our Father in heaven is holy. And so we put the emphasis on the ritual, because we can do that. And that's what Israel did. But God's emphasis is not there. God's emphasis is always on the moral. And it's in response to the moral law of God that Israel is able to carry out the purposes of God as he's looking forward to the coming of his Son into the world. Those are some of the things that the book of Joshua teaches. But they advance the history of Israel toward that goal of the Messiah coming into the world. And I hope you see that Israel is not an end. Israel is a means. Israel is the means through which God's salvation is to come to the whole world. Israel is the means through which the knowledge of the one true and living God is to spread through all the Gentile world. They are a means, not an end. We in the local church are a means, not an end. We are a means by which the good news of Jesus Christ goes out into the community and into the world. Our coming together is not an end in itself, it's a means. Because God's ultimate purpose is not to have a local church coming together. God's ultimate purpose is to have every knee bow to the Lordship of Jesus Christ. And through us, he wants that to happen in grace rather than by necessity. So God is building this nation so that through them, the knowledge of the one true and living God can reach the world. And ultimately, through them, his Son will be born into the world. All right, now let's come to Joshua chapter 1. I said enough about Joshua, the book, and fitting into the purposes of God. Joshua chapter 1. And let's read the first 9 verses. This is the only assembly building I have ever been in where a clock doesn't face the preacher. I have to watch. All right. Joshua chapter 1, let's read the first 9 verses. I'm using the New International Translation. After the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord said to Joshua, son of Nun, Moses' aide, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now then, you and all these people, get ready to cross the Jordan River into the land I am about to give to them, to the Israelites. I will give you every place where you set your foot, as I promised Moses. Your territory will extend from the desert and from Lebanon to the great river, the Euphrates, all the Hittite country, and to the great sea on the west. No one will be able to stand up against you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will never leave you nor forsake you. Be strong and courageous, because you will lead these people to inherit the land I swore to their forefathers to give them. Be strong and very courageous. Be careful to obey all the law my servant Moses gave you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, that you may be successful wherever you go. Do not let this book of the law depart from your mouth. Meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do everything written in it. Then you will be prosperous and successful. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be terrified. Do not be discouraged. For the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go. Psychologists tell us that the fear of failure is really the fear of success. I didn't believe that the first time I heard it. The more I thought about it, the more I concluded it's true. The fear of failure really masks the fear of success. And secretly, it's our fear of failure that keeps us from moving out into new ventures. It may be it's our fear of success that keeps us from moving out into new ventures. We all like the safety and the security of what we have known, no matter how bad it may be. We're safe. We know the boundaries. They may be bad boundaries, but we're familiar with them. And stepping outside those boundaries and moving out into a wider world is what fills us with fear. For instance, if you try to remove an abused child from his home and put him in a foster home, no matter how good that foster home is, he will resist with everything in him. He will be miserable and unhappy, no matter how much the foster parents may love him. He wants to go back to that abusive home. Not because he wants the abuse, but because that's his home. Those are his parents. That's the home he knows. That's where he belongs. And in spite of its abuse, there's a great deal of personal security for him, no matter how warped it may be. There's a great deal of personal security for him in that home. Going out into this new world, this new family, this new home, no matter how nice it may be, is frightening. When Israel in the wilderness faced new tests, they wanted to go back to Egypt. Let's get us another leader who will take us back to Egypt. We remember the leeks and the melons and the onions and the garlic. They must have been Italian, anyhow. That's what they remembered. What about the beatings and the slavery? From outside their experience, I look at that and say, no, you don't really want to go back to Egypt. But like the abused child, they do. In spite of the beatings and the slavery and the hardship, Egypt was home. Egypt was the familiar. Egypt was the secure. And to get back to that security, they ignored the slavery and the beating and remembered the onions and all the other good food they had. We are like that. I'm sure for each one of us, God over the years has called us to stretch our own personal experience. God has called us to enter new ground, to move out of the familiar and the safe. And we have been afraid to do it. Not because we might fail out there, but because we might succeed and never come back to the warmth and the security of what we know. Israel is in that position right now, on the edge of the Promised Land. Not only did they know Egypt, they now know the wilderness. They're facing a completely new country. Not only are they facing a new country in which they have never been before, never mind that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob grew up there. That's 400 years and more before. They've never been there. And they're going to go in without Moses. Moses, my servant, is dead. Moses is the one through whom God got them out of Egypt, led them through 38 years of the wilderness. Now here's Joshua. Now I know Joshua has been Moses' lieutenant for those 38 years. I know that, they could say. But Joshua has never been in command. Now it's Joshua who's going to lead us into the land. I can imagine some of the fears that ran through the camp And there were fears that ran through Joshua. Well, there's no reason for God saying over and over again, be courageous, be courageous, be strong, don't be afraid. God doesn't give us unnecessary instructions. It was very, very real to Joshua that Moses was dead. And Joshua, the responsibility is on your shoulders now. I want to take another sidetrack for a moment. One day, for each one of us, that statement is going to be made. Bill Anderson, I hope God will be able to say, my servant, is dead. Now, as you think of your position in the local church, are you preparing a Joshua? Moses prepared a Joshua. I want to throw out at least three things that Moses did with Joshua that got him ready for this position. One is that, and for those of you who are in leadership in the local church, to me this is vital. Joshua recognized and used the abilities, Moses recognized and used the abilities of Joshua. I think those of us in leadership positions are responsible to help people. In fact, we ought to be able to see, depending on how well we know our people, we ought to be able to see their abilities. I'm deeply indebted to older men, when I was a young man, for just that kind of help. I'm deeply indebted to a man who was an elder in one of the assemblies in Augusta, Georgia, when I was in my 20s, who spent hours with me. Unfortunately, it was 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. That's when he did his study. But he spent hours with me in the scriptures, fed me all kinds of books, taught me to read good authors, gave me opportunities to minister the word of God. He saw the gift God had given me that I myself was not sure of, but he was sure of. I'm indebted to Harold Harper, who, when we shared a conference when I was a very young man, took me aside and told me I was trying to use a gift I didn't have, but didn't stop there. He clearly saw, as he listened to me, the gift that I did have, and he pointed that out. Moses recognized the ability that Joshua had, and he gave him opportunity to use it. So that when they had to fight a battle, Joshua, go to it. The trouble with many of us who are in leadership positions is we can't do that with younger men. We want to get on there and tell them how to conduct the battle. In fact, if we're not sure they're doing it right, we'll take the battle over for them. But Moses saw Joshua's ability and let him use those abilities. He didn't try to take over Joshua's responsibilities. Now, that doesn't mean he separated himself from Joshua. Because the second thing Moses did for Joshua was give him instruction and counsel. More than once, Joshua would come to Moses before they invaded one of the lands, say, on the east side of the River Jordan, and ask, should we go ahead and do it? And Moses would talk with Joshua and suggest certain things, and let's talk to the Lord first. So he gave him counsel. The third thing that Moses did with Joshua was involve him in Moses' relationship with God. Joshua was there with Moses at the tent of meeting. Joshua went up into the mountain with Moses in the presence of God. Moses involved Joshua in Moses' own relationship with God. And I'm suggesting those of us who are older can do that with some of our younger men and women. It doesn't mean we have to know more than they do. And sometimes those of us who are older and don't have the education that some of the younger people have, we panic. No, you don't have to be more intelligent than they are. You don't have to know more than they do. You don't have to be sharper than they are. But you've had spiritual experience over the years that they have not had. And you can involve them in your relationship with God and your walk with God to help them in their growing and developing in the things of God. So when Moses, my servant, is dead, Joshua is ready to take over. But I want to come back to Joshua's fear in moving into something new. And I hope I'm striking some chords here, that some of you are aware of that God has been calling you to move out, to get into new territory, to try something different. Maybe you're in your own private life, and maybe your family life, and maybe your church life. And it's the fear of doing something different and succeeding at it, and not having the comfort zone of the familiar anymore. What does God say to Joshua? I want to suggest in these verses in chapter 1, there are three constants that will not change when you move into a new venture. And God is saying to Joshua, yes, Moses is dead. You can't lean on Moses. But when you move ahead into this new land, there are three things that will never change. One, God's promises. Verse 6, you're going to lead these people to inherit the land I swore to their forefathers to give them. When you go into that new country, Joshua, you are going in because I committed myself to Abraham. And you can bank on what I have promised. Promise. God gives us promises for that very reason. To encourage us to go ahead. Not to keep us secure where we are, but to give us the internal security that enables us to move out into something new. We too often find our security in the externals, the familiar. God wants us to have the internal security of what He has committed Himself to, so that we can risk moving out into the new. Lewis Smeads of Fuller Seminary, in what to me was a tremendously helpful article in Christianity Today several years ago, talked about making promises. He suggested that our ability to make promises is one of the ways in which we are most like God. I am not like God in the sense that I cannot control the future. I can't do that. I can't control circumstances. I don't know what those circumstances will be, and I can't control them. I am not like God. But what I can say to my wife, for instance, is, regardless of what the circumstances are in the future, I will be there with you. And what I am doing for her is carving out a piece of the future that she can count on. I can't control those circumstances, but I can control what I do. And by making promises, I am carving out a bit of security in the future. That's what God does for us. He doesn't tell us, I'm going to control all your circumstances. To be in control does not mean to be controlling. God doesn't say, I'm going to make everything nice for you. But God has committed Himself. He has promised us, I will be with you, and I will get you safely home. That's what He has promised us. And I can count on that. God has carved out for me a secure piece of the future. He has said nothing about my financial condition in the future. He has said nothing about my physical health in the future. He has said nothing about my circumstances. But he's carved out for me a piece of the future that I can count on. And that's his presence. And that he will get me safely home. That's what he has promised. And what God is saying to Joshua is, as you go into this new venture, as you move into this land, my promises remain unchanged. That's the first constant that God reminds Joshua of here. Second, in verses 7 and 8, this book of the law, God's precepts, his law. Now, I need to say something about the law of God. I was going to do it a little while ago, but I'm going to do it now. The view of the law with which I grew up was, and it may just be that I picked up this impression, it wasn't intended, is that it was entirely negative. And the only purpose of the law was to reveal sin. And then one day I began reading the Epistle of James, and I came across that expression, the law of liberty. Now, wait a minute. The law is bondage. The law is not liberty. And then as I read the Old Testament, as I was suggesting a little while ago, I found the delight of those writers in the law of God. How can you delight in something that condemns you? As I suggested, when people have found the basis of their relationship with God in the mercy of God, as for instance David had, then the law is not condemnation, the law is joy. So what does James mean by the law of liberty? Those of you who were here at the Labor Day weekend conference 3 or 4 years ago when we were trying to get through James, and I don't think we ever finished the first chapter, remember our discussion of the law of liberty in James chapter 1. And I'm indebted to G.K. Chesterton in his book Orthodox that I read years ago. And I have to admit, G.K. Chesterton is way over my head, but I did grab some things out of that book that were very, very helpful. He used the illustration that if you go down to the zoo, and you want to draw a picture of a giraffe, and you've got your sketch pad and your paints, etc., whatever you're going to use, and you park all your equipment in front of the giraffe cage, and you're going to draw a giraffe, and in the process you decide, I don't like that long neck, so I'm going to draw a giraffe with a short neck. If you take the liberty to draw a giraffe with a short neck, you must give up the liberty of drawing a giraffe. If you are going to draw a giraffe, you have to follow the laws of giraffeology. Right? It's only the laws of giraffeology that give you the liberty to draw a giraffe. It's only the laws of aerodynamics that give you the liberty to design and build a plane that will fly. If you decide to draw and design a plane that ignores the laws of aerodynamics, then you must give up the liberty to draw and build a plane that will fly. If you decide in the States to ignore the highway laws and drive 90 miles an hour on the left side of the highway, you will have to give up your right to life because you're going to kill yourself. The only way you can live on the highway, and even that's not guaranteed, is to follow the laws, the traffic laws of the state. The laws of God were designed not only to show us that we are not perfect, they were designed to help us to live in liberty. How can laws be liberty? Well, that's my illustration. Traffic laws give you the liberty to live and drive on the highway. Aerodynamic laws give you the liberty to design and build a plane that will fly. Ignore those laws and you lose that liberty. The laws of God give us the liberty to live the way God designed us to live. Ignore the laws and you lose that liberty. The law is a curse only when you are trying to make obedience to that law the basis of your relationship with God. Then it's a curse. It wasn't designed for that. Paul argues that very strongly. Not even the Old Testament wasn't designed for that. It was designed to give the people of God liberty. Liberty from what? Liberty from the kind of life the Canaanites live. And all you have to do is read the way they live. To go before God and thank God for His law. That's all you have to do. Preserve Israel from that kind of life. You mothers, would you enjoy the liberty of taking your infant child that you suckled, put that child in the red-hot arms of an idol over a flame and offer it up to that God? Law liberated Israel from that kind of life. So God says, you have my law. And when you move into the land of Canaan, with its destructive lifestyle, and it's destructive, it's my law that will set you free to live as the people of God. You follow that, and you live in joy and in life and in the blessing of God. My law is with you. Now there's a responsibility to that, of course, and that's to meditate on it and to do it. Of course, that's the way to life. That's how to live, to do what God says. Everything else is destructive. God created us. He knows what's best for us. He knows how to get the fullness of His design out of us so that we really enjoy living. And it's too bad that we buy all the commercials as to what gives meaning to life. God's the only one that really knows what makes life worthwhile. And it's as we do what He says that life takes on real meaning and purpose and gives zest and joy to it. That's why He has given us those instructions. So we better think about it, meditate on it. That is, we are thinking people. It's not enough to know the law. God expected His people to take those commands, to think about them, and to think about life, and put the situations they were facing together with the instructions of the law and come up with what to do. Now, in my judgment, it's very unfortunate that leaders in Israel later on couldn't trust the people of God to do that. So they came up with hundreds of laws that would fill volumes, as it does, that would apply the law to every possible situation in life. That was the intolerable burden that neither we nor our fathers were able to bear. God didn't do that. He said, here are my commands. You work them out in your life. That means you've got to do some thinking. Given the situation I'm facing, given the commands of God, how do I relate those commands to this situation that I'm facing? Now that's exciting. That means God says, hey, you're mature. I trust you. Go ahead. Work it out. Meditate. That's the idea. You've got to do some thinking about it and relate those commands to your own life situation. So, Joshua, you've got my law. Wonderful. What a blessing. What a blessing. You're not left in the dark. You don't have to take up your lifestyle from the Canaanites around you. Thank God for that.
I've given you my law. Bless God for that. That's not all God said. He said, I've given you my presence. Verse 9. I will be with you wherever you go. I like the way God describes himself in Revelation chapter 1. I am he who is, and who was, and who is to come. The God who was is the God without beginning. The God who is to come is the God without end. The God who is the God without interruption. He is without beginning, he is without end, he is without interruption. He always was, is, and will be. But I like to think of it in terms of myself. The God who was. God is in my past. It's past to me, but God is in my past. The wonderful thing about having God in your past is that he has rewritten it. If Satan were to write my history, it would be completely different from the way God writes it. When Satan would be through writing my history, every sin I have ever committed would be in it. God has written my history. There isn't a mention of anyone else. They've all been forgiven. Blotting out the record. Paul tells the Colossians. I'm glad he is the God who was. He's in my past. And he's in my future. I don't know what the future holds, but God is already there. The future to me, it's not to him. He's already there. Doesn't matter what happens in Minnesota. God is already there. And Joshua, when you get into Canaan, you're going to find God there. He's already there. There isn't any place God isn't. He's already there. But he's the God who is. He's here now with us. You're afraid of moving out into new areas of life. You're aware that God is calling you to expand your life. You're aware that God is moving you into new areas. And you're really afraid to go. That's understandable. But you have the promises of God. You have the good word of God. And you have the presence of God. So just put your name in place of Joshua. Joshua, don't be afraid. Let's pray.